Tune into Near FM every Tuesday in April for The Global Thread. In partnership with COLOV, this series will hear from people involved in international struggles for reproductive rights. We'll speak to communities affected by fracking and look at the international global architecture for fracking and mining industries. We'll hear from Irish organisations involved in the deinstitutionalisation of orphanages and moves to family and community-based care. And we'll also examine how global inequality and poverty is impacted by debt rules and global tax agreements. Each programme features interviews with people at the front line in fighting for a sustainable future for our planet. The 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development was adopted by all United Nations member states in 2015. It describes itself as providing a shared blueprint for peace and prosperity for people on the planet now and into the future. It goes on to say that at its heart, there are 17 Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, which are an urgent call for action by all countries, developed and developing, in a global partnership. They recognise that ending poverty and other deprivations must go hand in hand with strategies that improve health and education, reduce inequality, and spur economic growth, all while tackling climate change and working to preserve our oceans and forests. The Irish government was very involved in getting agreement back in 2015 and bringing these forward. There's a lot of overlap in the Sustainable Development Goals, but the key ones that we'll be looking at over these four episodes will be Sustainable Development Goal 1, which is end poverty in all its form everywhere. Sustainable Development 3, good health and well-being. And Goal 9, to build resilient infrastructure, promote inclusive and sustainable industrialisation. Over the course of the series, we'll examine how well we're doing in these, both in Ireland and internationally. Welcome to The Global Thread, a four-part series from COLOV where we explore some of today's social movements for social justice and look at Ireland's sometimes fraught place within those. I'm your host, Mark Malone. In today's programme, we'll be talking to activists in Ireland and abroad that will take us through the work they do to ensure that sustainable energy policies are a political priority. Mining causes massive ecological damage, and is often accompanied by human rights abuses against people trying to protect their land. Amidst this, there's been noticeable successes as a result of grassroots campaigns in Ireland that ban fracking, and these can be understood as a contribution to Ireland's commitment to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. So today we're going to be talking to people who are mining for hope. First, I spoke to Linda Sullivan, a writer and human rights activist. She currently works with Friends of the Earth Northern Ireland. Previous to this, she spent 5 years accompanying the indigenous Campesino communities in the northern highlands of Peru as they resisted the impositions of mega mining projects that would destroy their water supply and ancestral lands. I start by asking Linda about types of mining that communities in the north of Ireland are facing.
There's a few forms of mining. There's underground mining and open pit mining. So the open pit mining would basically entail just digging away at the top of the mountain, like from the top down, and creating a huge crater, and then using the extracted rock, milling it down first of all, and then washing it in chemicals such as cyanide, and then that washing of the milled down rock then separates the minerals from the rock. So the waste rock then is dumped, usually on site or close to the mine, and then that processed the minerals then are usually then taken away and processed elsewhere.
Sian Kamen previously worked as a human rights defender and was involved in solidarity campaigns during her time with the Center for Democracy in Bolivia. I spoke to her about mining in Colombia.
The area is completely militarized, so we were driving in between huge chain link fences with barbed wire on top of them and military checkpoints everywhere. We had to hide our cameras. And we visited a woman who has a little restaurant right on the edges of the mine, like she's serving food to mine workers. And right outside, like it's a mud track, but basically the mud is like coal dust, it's black. And right outside there was like a weighing station for the coal trucks. So every 5 minutes there are these huge rumbling trucks pulling up and like weighing the coal. The atmosphere is tense. The view is really like it feels like being, it feels a little bit like being in a war zone, even though of course it's not anywhere near that bad.
So just what does it look like for communities to have a mine of this scale in the region? I wanted to know what community resistance looked like when people are trying to protect their lands they've lived on for generations.
Because it's often like indigenous, rural, and Afro communities that are most affected by extractive industries, often those types of communities are already really marginalized by the state. So they have really strong community organization, much more so than anything we would be used to here in Ireland, or certainly anything I've experienced, at the level of having community groups that have elections and elected leaders and rotation of roles. And so many communities will use those existing structures as part of their resistance to mining. But of course, that can be challenging, because mining companies will not only try to buy off local politicians, but they will try to buy off local social leaders. And if they can't buy them off, they'll find a way to use state judicial processes to criminalize them in the courts, or leaders will receive death threats, basically. There's no really way to prove that the companies are behind those directly, but they're receiving the threats directly because of their resistance against these mining companies. So communities organize, have very strong forms of organizing to resist extractive projects, but they're also facing really, really difficult opposition that is also able to access local politics and national politics and national laws. For example, the Mapuche people in Chile have been consistently criminalized and jailed under anti-terrorism laws. So while there's a lot to learn from like indigenous and rural forms of organization for resisting in Latin America, we also have to look at the impacts that they're dealing with as a result of that.
Sian then spoke about the connection here in Ireland.
The Colombian state has facilitated this mining operation to happen, and across the country. They call it the locomotor minero energético, the mining energetic locomotive. Like it's this barreling train that you can't stop. That's the kind of perception or visualization of how the state is supporting these mining and extractive projects. When you speak out about this in the specific case of the Cerrejón mine, they say, yes, but Colombia, they need the tax take, they need our contribution to the economy. But actually, the Cerrejón mine has a separate sales company called CMC, the coal marketing company, which is based in Dublin. So all of their coal is bought and sold through an office in Dublin. The Irish corporate tax rate is 12.5% and the Colombian corporate tax rate is 34%. Now, I can't say with certainty, I can't put my hand on my heart and say I have the proof that they're tax dodging, but it doesn't take a genius to figure out, well, why would they have a separate company that's owned by the same three multinationals that own the mine, which are BHP Billiton, Glencore, and Anglo American. So BHP Billiton is the largest mining corporation in the world. Glencore isn't far behind. These are massive multinationals.
Mm-hmm.
Back north of the border, Linda speaks about what alternatives to the mining as it is planned currently might actually look like.
Well, in our opinion, well, Friends of the Earth, we're advocating for participatory land use planning from the very beginning. So communities, well, the state needs to engage with communities to see what the land should be used for, and preferably prioritising sustainable industries such as farming and fishing and sustainable tourism, industries that don't have a 10 or 20 year lifespan and leave the place devastated. And also where, if there are places identified where mining could happen, then it's done the right way, such as mining licenses need to include a human rights assessment and strategic environmental assessments, as well as climate proofing. And that is not being done by the Northern Irish state at all. So we see the state as completely failing to protect community rights and to protect our environment. So the role that the state has been undertaking to us is facilitating the ingression of multinational corporations. You know, the Department of the Economy was in Toronto last year and this year promoting Ireland as open for business, as was the government of the South of Ireland. So that's completely contradictory to the role that they should have, which is the protection of its citizens and the rights of the people.
So earlier I mentioned the success of movements in getting fracking banned in Ireland. But as Sian pointed out, it's not that simple. We should be looking at the global interconnected processes around fracking, which Ireland is very much involved in.
Like, Ireland's victory banning fracking has been so amazing, but it's so important for campaigners, like environmental campaigners in the global north, to be aware that their victories can translate, maybe not directly, but they can translate into destruction for communities in the global south. Because it's no coincidence that as like France, Ireland and other richer countries ban fracking, there's more fracking happening in Latin America and in other global south and like impoverished, marginalized countries. So that's why I think it is amazing that there's now this campaign in Ireland around the liquefied natural gas terminal, which from my understanding would be importing gas that has been fracked gas that has already been converted to LNG in Texas, and then would be shipped to Ireland for then distribution around Europe. So people might say, oh yeah, but the United States, you know, that's another rich country. But most fracking on the United States happens in Native American reservations and in like African American communities.
What Sian and Linda have kind of mapped out for us is a global architecture of mining and fracking. I'm going to take that up with our next guest. In March 2018, Esteban Servant helped spark the global anti-fracking movement after he published a secret government document that showed that the fracking industry in his home country of Argentina was contaminating water. He published the secret Argentinian government study of the environmental impacts of fracking in the mountainous region of Mendoza. A report that had been provided to him by a whistleblower inside the government of President Macri. The study revealed that the Macri administration knew about the contamination of aquifers due to fracking operations, but lied to the public about the scope of the risk. I wanted to find out more about EcoLeaks. What was that?
We were able to get a copy of this and created EcoLeaks. You know, WikiLeaks, so we tried to make an environmental version of that and published it. And this led to a massive revolt in Mendoza and also a massive fight against the government, who turned against me mainly as a target to turn me into an example, to try to quiet, you know, to appease or to silence everyone else, to demobilize them by making an example of myself. So I became the most persecuted person in Argentina for fighting fracking in terms of criminal cases. We suffered political operations. They planted drugs on our farm, followed by a media operation campaign saying we were drug dealers that must be investigated. It didn't work. We thwarted that operation anyways. They invaded our farm. They sent a couple with fake documents and a bulldozer from the government who entered our farm from one end. It's a big farm and I'm not patrolling it every day. It's wild and no one lives there. It's a depopulated region. So they entered through one end that was inaccessible. They broke in, they deforested a native forest population that is in danger that was there. They built up an improvised hut, brought a notary public to certify their so-called possessions, and filed a case against us as if we were invading them. And they filed the case as we had just found out about them and we were on our way to the police, so we filed a case against them. And it also backfired on the government because a year later they were sentenced, only the two actual usurpers. The government itself, whose hand was behind it, was not yet proven. I was about to file another lawsuit, but this is about the time when the death threats intensified against me and I recently left. In March of this year, I moved to Germany. I'm living in Berlin now because of the death threats and persecution that I got.
Given that Esteban had to flee Argentina due to death threats, I was curious about what type of repression the communities in Mendoza faced.
If you have a relative working for the government, or being a teacher works for the government, right, for the state, and they can be fired, they were actually threatened. So people going to protest, if they had a relative, they were more and more pushed to not go because someone in their family could suffer the consequences. And that's one way they demobilize the people. And then censoring the group had a huge impact because it's part of many other things that happened, like a code of conduct that the government of Mendoza managed to approve last October, where they criminalize your expressions on social media. If you say something bad about the governor or some public official and they take offense, they can put you in jail or give you a big fine. If you call on demonstrations, they can put you in jail or give you a big fine. So it resembles what we had in the dictatorship times of the 70s. There was no social media there, but everything else that this code has is very similar. So we are facing a very restrictive, less and less democratic system that is turning Argentina and the global south into a colonial place for extraction of riches for the north.
So why did the state back the corporations over the protection of people's land, economy and human rights in Mendoza?
The movement that was built upon this was the biggest in the world at the time. Tens of thousands of people on the streets, even unprecedented for Mendoza, that had huge resistance fights before. So it was a very powerful movement. We did a lot of actions, blockade of roads and demonstrations, but they would never allow us to win in a fight like this because Mendoza is sitting on the second largest gas and oil, unconventional fracking gas, shale gas and oil field in the world, known as Vaca Muerta. And the other provinces that lie on top, Vaca Muerta is bigger than Denmark in size. It's huge, 30,000 square kilometers. I don't know exactly the size of Ireland, but maybe bigger than Ireland. Yeah. So the exploitation of Vaca Muerta would consume more than 11% of the total carbon budget that the planet has left. 11, and the emissions produced by that are equivalent to the whole planet's emissions for more than a year. So it needs to be stopped. The UN has requested Argentina not to tap into that, but of course they're doing this for money. And the reason they would not allow us, or they put so much power behind fighting and persecuting us and so on, is that a success in Mendoza would be the first one of the whole, you know, this field lies beneath several provinces, and the other provinces have had fracking for several years, since 2013 now. And Mendoza had not, because of its environmental history, it was not easy to do that. So the only one who dared to do that was this governor who was new at the time. So if we succeeded in defeating fracking in Mendoza, the populations of the neighboring provinces would rise up, inspired and supported by us. And this is unacceptable for them, you know, that there's billions and billions of dollars on the ground, there's already billions in investment to take it out, and they could not afford that. So they have treated, this has been a very special case. It's not we have put up maybe the biggest fight, but also we're fighting maybe the biggest reservoir. So it's been very intense, a lot of confrontation, a lot of things happening, a lot of persecution, people having to leave, people put in jail, people suffering all kinds of political operations. But anyway, I'm hopeful that this will still change, because the people will not take this forever. Mendoza is going through the worst drought in history, which is exacerbated by fracking, which is using up to 40 million liters of water per well, up in the birthplace of the rivers, which now have less than half of the average of water that they need to have. So agriculture has been, they're killing it. People have to leave the farmland, and this is what they're trying to make, to change the agricultural productive matrix by one of fracking and mountaintop mining, which the same people that were against mining, as I was telling you, and now brought fracking, they are now working to destroy the law that they themselves managed to approve, because they can't wait to get their hands on the gold and silver that are there. This Mendoza is extremely rich in minerals, so they can't wait to get them out.
Somos más esta humanidad. No queremos ser más esta humanidad.
While I don't agree with Esteban's assertion that people and communities in the Global South have no power in that situation, I kind of understand the dynamics that he's talking about. If you're interested in finding out more about today's episode, or want to find out more about Kolov's audio work, make sure and subscribe to the Focus podcast. You can find that on Kolov's website, comhlahmh.org, or check out Nearcast.
This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.